This is talking with H. Lawrence Helfer at the AAS meeting in Baltimore on 12th June, 1984. That last date should have been 9 June. This is 12th June, and let me first ask you, what was your background educationally, and how did you first come in contact with radio astronomy?
Well, I went to the University of Chicago as an undergraduate, and then I went up to Yerkes. I was a theoretician, mm-hmm. and I worked on Deschandra. Mm-hmm. Jobs were hard to get in those days.
What year are we talking about?
Well, I went to, I went to Chicago in 47. I got my bachelor's degree in about 48, and I was in the physics department for a little while. And then I went up to Yerkes, and I got my Ph.D. by 53.
Mm-hmm. And what was the subject matter of that?
And the thesis there consisted of two parts. One was on hydromagnetic shocks, working on the Hoffman and Teller's pioneer work at the time. And the other was on a phenomenon which today we would call solitons. Gravitational solitons, nonlinear solutions in the gravitational, in the genes type problem.
So this is a long way from radio astronomy.
Yeah, it was a long way from radio astronomy by far, and I didn't know what to do for a job, and there weren't many jobs. There was one job opening, and there was one fellowship opening when I graduated, and we had a large graduating class. There were four of us that graduated. Nelson Limba, who went to Princeton, mm-hmm. on a postdoc, and there were two other fellows.
Mm-hmm.
Johnson, who's at Lockheed.
Oh yes, Hugh Johnson.
Hugh Johnson. Mm-hmm. And there was a fourth fellow named Previtt. And I guess Chandra must have spoken to Kuiper, and Kuiper knew everybody in those days. And Kuiper was the original astronomer hitting the Washington circuit, so he knew Merle too,
mm-hmm.
and he told me that there was a job, he could get me a job, a fellowship at DTM, if I wanted it. So I said, sure, you know. In those days, I was very much of a mathematical a physicist, and I wouldn't bother on anything more practical. All I wanted was a place where I could push equations for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I had found out they had two very famous theoreticians at DTM at the time. Merle Tubbs didn't appreciate that in a real sense, but they were very good people. One was Vess Dean, who had done pioneer work on the Earth's magnetic field, and the other was Scott Forbush,
mm-hmm.
who had done the statistical analysis, mm-hmm. and is more famous today than he was then.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, sure, there'd at least be some reason for me to do hydromagnetic. So I got interviewed for a job, and they pulled me down there, and I spoke to Merle Tube and Tatum, and I met a whole bunch of people there, and I got offered the job.
So when did you go there, actually?
My memory's a little faint on that. I don't remember whether it's June or September of 53, but it's within that range of time there. I think got there a few days before Bernie Burke,
mm-hmm.
so you can check on that. We shared an office when I went down there. He and John Farrar were hired as staff members. I was a postdoc.
Right.
At the time, George Wetherill was working for Aldrich. Wetherill is now the present director of DTM,
mm-hmm.
and is quite outstanding in planetary astronomy.
Right. So what did you find going on in radio astronomy when you got
there? In radio astronomy, there was very, very little, actually. They had one dish which was completed when I first came there. This was the old Wurzburg that they had. They had a group of basically Merle Tube and Howard Tato trying to get the receiver working.
Mm-hmm.
And they had two technicians working on them. One was Eklund, whom you may remember.
No, I don't.
And the other one I don't remember. But what just occurred to me in speaking is that when I got down there, there were two students that were working that I had taken over from. They were finishing up their summer stint.
Mm-hmm.
So that places the date.
Right.
And they really were working with the equipment there.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was George Field.
I'll be darned.
So you could speak to George Field and
as a summer job.
To your list. That was his summer job before he started graduate work.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And he will remember. Okay. Now the equipment there actually gave an output on an Esterline Angus recorder.
Right.
It was a wiggly thing with a wiggly bass line. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. More often it didn't. And most of the time I sat around watching the damn thing and cursing and watching Merle too kick and jolly the thing around.
Right, but I don't understand. You're a theorist. How are you getting involved with this very practical data taking?
In those days, you see, as astronomers, we had a universal education. I earned a living at Jerby's, for example, being an observer.
I see.
That was my assistantship, or being a laboratory. I ran an optics laboratory downstairs as well. So we were expected to know everything and be able to do anything there. And, that particular
so that didn't phase you? I mean,
was straightforward. I have been well taught in things like parallax theory, and I knew what theory and all of that stuff stand. It was obvious what sort of problems to do.
Mm-hmm.
The real painful thing on the 21 centimeter work in the 50s, if you want to know, is that you knew exactly what you wanted to do, but the equipment couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until the late 60s that an awful lot of the problems were there. I mean, you knew you wanted to look for hydrogen in other galaxies. You wanted to check the outflow around certain types of stars. You wanted to check it from globular clusters. You wanted to get the mass to dust ratio in place. And all the gas to dust ratio, we knew what to do.
Right.
And this damn thing wouldn't work whenever you wanted to. In fact, we didn't even have decent resolution. That thing had a resolution of about a degree or so.
Yeah, that's about right, yeah.
At the time. And, what we finally did, the only thing that had been available at that time was the original Dutch survey, which we had in a Xerox call.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, that was finished around late 53 or 54
or something.
Yeah, and
we had one of these blueprint type copies of the thing.
Right.
They had done it around the plane. So the natural thing, whenever you're doing any new astronomy, is to make a survey. Of course, here's the first survey there. So we were going to go perpendicular to the plane. And the first two meridional plane surveys were just taken with that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And with them we, of course, found the extended atmosphere, so to speak, of the home arm. And we could delineate the arms down.
It was a good bit more gas than expected away from the plane.
Yes, there was, really. That's never really been satisfactorily explained, why the gas seems to just go on a bit. It's a low level, but it's there, and there's no question about it.
Let me ask a question about the status of radio astronomy at that time. From what you've been saying, it sounds like you accepted it as a completely legitimate part of astronomy, and just another technique. Do I have that correct?
Oh, yes, I think that's quite right. Shamba told me before I left that this was a new field of astronomy. It's up and coming and it'll be major. You work hard on it, you're bound to do real well. The places, I think, on the West Coast and the Midwest, at least, not the conventional astronomy places, were perfectly willing to regard radio astronomy as being absolutely it. After all, it had odds sponsoring it.
Well, at least in 21 centimeter.
Yes, at least the 21 centimeter. Now, at the same time, Merle too wanted me to get interested, I think, in equipment building. and so forth. Granny was billed as stringing one set of antennas out in the field, and John Farrer was stringing another set. I really didn't want to get involved with equipment design, especially because it was tricky. People did not know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The reason people like Bernie Mills were pulled in there was because there was a fine art in mm-hmm. knowing what part of the oscillators or the amplifiers to
right.
shield where the pickup was coming
right.
from. So it was this sort of a thing that Merle, too, was trying to gain time on by picking the brains
right.
of everybody, inviting everybody
in. You had Graham Smith there for a year.
Absolutely.
Right.
Graham, I became very good friends with all these
mm-hmm.
people there. I don't remember if John Bolton was through there, at least for a little while. I know I saw him in Caltech,
mm-hmm.
and I have the impression that I had met him before. And people like Chris,
Christensen.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sure they all flew through.
Mm-hmm.
Merle, too, was an extremely
was
energetic
polymath,
man.
Of course, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
And he would pull in anybody who he could think to help him.
But now, let me just follow up on your remark about that certain institutions accepted radio astronomy, but you implied there were others that didn't. Could you be more specific?
I'm not, well, not on tape.
Okay.
Okay, because I wasn't there and so forth. I always had, let me just give you a minor example. Yeah, I know Bach was trying hard at
mm-hmm.
Harvard
right.
at the time. But I don't think he got the slightest bit of help from anybody else at Harvard. I mean, Harvard at that time was living 40 years behind the time. They thought they were the same institution that Harlow Shapley had
walked when he first went there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I did not have much respect for most of Harvard astronomy at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's that sort of thing. And there were a whole bunch of, all of astronomy was oriented optically.
Mm-hmm.
And not simply optically, but they didn't want even theoreticians or astrophysicists in there. The only place, I mean, Harvard's real glory, and Princeton's importance, of course, was that they introduced physics
mm-hmm.
into astronomy there.
Mm-hmm.
Harvard's great accomplishment, in my point of view, was Larry Auer and Leo Goldberg. They gave them places to work. And they started developing applications of atomic theory there. Now, Menzel may have done it in the early 30s, but my God, by the 50s, he was
mm-hmm.
living in a dream world.
So what about the other parts of radio astronomy? We've been talking about 21 centimeter. Were they somehow different from 21 centimeter in terms of the amount of integration with traditional astronomy?
Yes, they certainly were. The real difficulty was that they didn't have the resolution, you see, and no one could see what they really were looking at. I mean, that was a real
mm-hmm.
problem. We
Whereas
had
with
none
the hydrogen
of the
line, you had an idea of what you were looking
not
at.
Not only that, it was very clear and very precise what to do with the hydrogen
right.
line. All right.
right?
You knew that you
like
were looking
you were
cold
yeah.
hydrogen, you know you could get galactic
mm-hmm.
dynamics, there's no question about to do it. You could take, my God, you can wake a good astronomer up at 3 a.m. in the morning and he should have been able to rattle off 10 problems that you could do with sensitive
yeah.
equipment.
Yeah, right.
There, so that was no problem. The other bit, the radio astronomy is really intriguing. But we weren't even quite sure of the mechanism, because even
sure.
though Shalovsky had come out in 53 for that, it wasn't really common knowledge
right.
or accepted or
well,
circulated.
Let me just pursue that point, since I might forget otherwise. When do you recall that synchrotron radiation as the mechanism for the galactic background and perhaps for many radio sources generally became accepted?
I would say about a couple of years before the Burbage paper.
57, that would be, the Burbage paper is 59.
Yeah, that's what I would guess,
mm-hmm.
all right? When Jeff's paper came out, I said, boy, he can write well. But, and this is really just
the one
thing.
On the energetics of radio
that's
sources, right?
Yeah, I mean, that was a very general paper for mm-hmm. pointing out what the energy problem was.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no denying that that paper, I taught for it for years and years, well after people.